Point Mizar east one last time. Almost as soon as Mizar passed east of Point Oscar, its long-range sonar registered iron, and lots of it. Mizar steamed ahead full speed, right past Craven's point of highest probability, and then lowered its cameras for another look. All it found was iron ore-filled rock. That was it. The end. Shade and Clary had had about all the disappointment they could take. The decision was made. It was time to give up. Time to call Buck Buchanan and Mizar home. Buchanan, pugnacious and stubborn as ever, refused to accept their decision. He flashed a message to Craven. "Can't you get the Navy to let us stay out another month or a week or 2 weeks? Tell them I need to calibrate the area for future operations." Craven knew that there was nothing left to calibrate. But Craven also knew that if Buck Buchanan wanted to stay out, it could mean only one thing. The oceanographer was going to take Mizar to the spot Craven and his team had pinpointed. Craven went to the admirals and began mixing his rapid-fire logic with pleas. By the time he was finished, he had won 2 more weeks. Exactly 1 week later, Craven received a one-line missive from the survey ship. Buchanan shaved his beard. Craven didn't need any translation. Scorpion had been found. It was October 29th, almost 5 months to the day that she had been declared missing. Mizar found Scorpion within 220 yards, one-eighth of a mile, of where Craven, his mathematicians, and a group of experts betting for bottles of scotch had said she would be. The sub was 11,000 feet underwater. Dangling cameras, Mizar took photographs showing Scorpion half buried in silt and sand, and separated into two pieces that were barely held together by a small hinge of metal. The forward part of the engine room had imploded, and in a fraction of a second, collapsed like a telescope into the auxiliary machine space. The propeller and the propeller shaft were separated from the hull altogether. So was the submarine's sail. Lying near the submarine was Scorpion's sextant, an age-old symbol of navigation. No navigator, officer, or crewman was anywhere in sight. It was impossible to see inside the submarine, or even the outside, in much detail. Although Mizar's cameras dangled only between 10 and 50 feet over Scorpion, the overhead pictures looked as though they'd been photographed through a deep fog. A court of inquiry looking into the disaster was made up of 7 naval officers and chaired by retired Vice Admiral Bernard L. Count Austin, who had also led the inquiry into Thresher's sinking. In a January 1969 press release, the Navy told the public that the Court of Inquiry, after a 6-month investigation, had concluded that the Scorpion disaster remained a mystery, that the cause could not be ascertained from any evidence now available, and that no incontrovertible proof of the exact cause could be found. Indeed, the Navy publicly appeared to rule out a torpedo disaster of any sort, saying, "Procedures used in handling ordnance on board were consistent with established safety precautions." Then it went on to boast that testimony also established a long history of safety in submarine torpedoes. Technically, the Navy told the truth, but in such a limited form that the result was a massive evasion that bordered on an outright lie. In fact, when the court's more detailed findings were finally released in 1993, they showed that it had concluded that the top 3 probable causes of Scorpion's loss all involved torpedo accidents. Leading the list was Craven's theory that there was a hot-running torpedo on board Scorpion, perhaps caused when crewmen tested torpedoes in preparation for their arrival home. But then the court veered from Craven's theory that the torpedo exploded on board Scorpion. Instead, it speculated, Acting on impulse and perhaps influenced by successful ejection of a Mark 37 exercise shot, which was running hot in the tube in December 1967, the torpedo was released from the tube, became fully armed, and sought its nearest target, Scorpion. The court acknowledged there was no evidence of an external torpedo hit, but reasoned that there was also a lack of any visible torpedo room debris near Scorpion, which would prove that the explosion occurred inside the sub. Former submarine torpedo men say it is almost unthinkable that Scorpion's crew would have panicked and jettisoned a war-shot torpedo. The 1967 incident involved a torpedo meant for practice shots that carried only a dummy warhead and no live explosives. The court seems to have crafted a compromise for its classified findings. Citing Craven and his acoustic evidence, the court concluded that a torpedo was at fault, but the contention of an outside explosion seemed patterned on the ordnance system's command's insistence that it was impossible for a hot run to lead to an onboard explosion. Also in the report was a list of possible submarine accidents of all types, prepared by the Bureau of Ships. The list included gas leaks, broken hydraulic lines, fires, and more. But only one item on the list showed catastrophic results. A weapons accident. That, the Bureau said, would result in loss of ship. In mid-1969, the Navy directed a top-secret effort to try to examine more closely the submarine's wreckage and unravel the mystery. It was most interested in the torpedo room and the torpedo doors. The Trieste II was sent down for a closer look. The first dive was made on July 16th, only days before the Apollo 11 astronauts made the first manned landing on the moon. "My God, what a crazy world we live in," Craven muttered to himself as he stood on the floating dock that had launched the Trieste. "We think we're doing a technological feat, which is every bit as difficult and every bit as meaningful to humans as this man-on-the-moon thing, and we're the only ones who will get the chance to savor this operation." Trieste made 9 dives that year. Watching the first from monitors aboard the floating dry dock were Craven and Captain Harry Jackson, the engineer who had helped test Thresher, and never stopped being haunted by his near miss on that sub. They could see that there was no evidence of attack, and no evidence of an external torpedo hit. But there was also no conclusive evidence to show just what had sent Scorpion to the ocean bottom. Craven would always struggle with the last piece of the puzzle. He was nearly certain a torpedo blew up inside Scorpion. But how? It all seemed to end there, with the question left unanswered, with the families of the Scorpion men left to wander in nightmares of explosions and phantom battles and disbelief. "All we ever wanted was an explanation," said Barbara Barr Gillum, who lost her 21-year-old brother, Joseph Anthony Barr, Jr. "After the disaster, everything was covered up." The Scorpion disaster quickly faded from the greater public conscience, which was already being battered by nightly images of bullets flying, soldiers bleeding, and a seemingly endless line of body bags in Vietnam. The Scorpion families might have been left alone to forever struggle with their own investigations had the Navy not decided to mark the grisly quarter-century anniversary of Scorpion's loss by releasing the Court of Inquiry's conclusions and videotapes of her sunken shell. By then, Craven was 69 years old and long gone from the Navy. He was, instead, intensely involved in developing a new form of agriculture in Hawaii. The Chicago Tribune printed a story about the documents and his role in using his torpedo theory to find Scorpion. It was only when that story ran that Craven was handed what he is convinced is the last piece of the puzzle. It all played out in a scene reminiscent of the final chapter of a detective novel. The Tribune article reached the desk of Charles M. Thorne, who had been technical director of the Weapons Quality Engineering Center at the Naval Torpedo Station in Keyport, Washington. Seeing Craven's name in print, Thorne picked up the telephone and dialed. The two men had never met. Neither had known anything about the other during the long Scorpion search and all the years after. Still, they had much in common. Thorne, too, had long had reason to fear that a torpedo had been the cause of Scorpion's death. Back in the spring of 1968, he had been a top engineer in the Keyport lab responsible for testing torpedoes and their components. He worked there for 25 years, and by the time he called Craven, he had been retired for 12 years. All that time, he had held information about Scorpion that he felt barred by classification rules from telling anyone. Now, the engineer reached out to the scientist. Thorne asked Craven whether he had seen a classified alert that had been mailed in mid-May 1968 to the department that had been renamed the Naval Ordnance Command. The letter described a test failure of an MK-46 battery that was designed to power the Mark 37 torpedo, a fast-moving warshot that had been deemed the primary weapon for use against Soviet subs. He was referring to an alert that the testing lab had sent to Rear Admiral Arthur Gralla, who headed that command. Then Thorne went on to describe its contents. He knew them well since he had written the alert himself, although it had been reviewed and signed by Captain James L. Honeycutt, the CO of the station, and a decorated World War II submarine skipper, who has since died. In the alert, the lab reported that a torpedo battery had exploded in flames during a vibration test because a tiny foil diaphragm, a part worth pennies, had failed. As Thorne related this to Craven, the news seemed to parallel the discovery that the failure of inexpensive rubber O-rings had caused the Space Shuttle Challenger to explode. About a yard long and 17 inches wide, the batteries on Mark 37s were bolted within about an inch of the torpedo warheads, and each warhead carried 330 pounds of HBX explosive. The lab's alert had recommended that all batteries from that production lot be withdrawn from service at the earliest opportunity. And it said that sufficient heat was generated in the test sample to risk warhead cook-off and loss of a submarine. This alert was the strongest of any ever issued by the testing lab. It was the only time in the lab's 12 years of operation that it had ever warned of the possibility of a failure that could have life-threatening consequences. It was because the engineers were so deeply concerned that they had their commanding officer sign the alert. They wanted the added emphasis. Scorpion was carrying 14 Mark 37 torpedoes, and she was lost days after the letter was sent. Horrified at the possible connection, lab engineers specifically asked the Naval Ordnance Command about the torpedoes Scorpion was carrying. The Navy keeps records and serial numbers of all torpedo components and where they are issued. One of the lab's engineers remembers being told verbally that one of the batteries powering a torpedo on Scorpion did indeed come from the same production lot as the torpedo battery that had exploded at Keyport. Other former engineers there said they did not remember hearing this. Over the past several years, one of the engineers made requests for the battery records under the Freedom of Information Act, hoping they might answer that question once and for all. But the answer came back twice, that no such records could be found. Still, Thorne believes that a warhead cook-off initiated by a battery fire was the likely cause of Scorpion's loss, and he became all the more convinced of that when he read that Craven had concluded that Scorpion had suffered an internal torpedo explosion. He was stunned that Craven had never seen the lab's alert. Thorne had always assumed that the secret missive had been shown to the people involved in trying to make sense of the Scorpion disaster. Now it seemed that vital information had been withheld from Craven and the Court of Inquiry. Thorne asked Craven for a copy of the videocassette of Scorpion's wreckage and the Court of Inquiry report. After viewing those, he wrote to Craven with his analysis. I have agonized for years over what more we might have done to have averted that tragedy, Thorne said in the letter. The people that did the testing, the workmen and other engineers, we all wondered. We asked questions. Thorne then went on to tell Craven that his worst fears were borne out by Scorpion's wreckage. The videotape clearly shows that the upper hatch covers of the torpedo loading hatch and the escape trunk hatch are gone. Both hatches lead into the torpedo room. Both, Thorne wrote, could have been blown away as the result of a violent explosion inside the torpedo room, and that could have resulted in massive and uncontrollable flooding of the submarine. The battery failure that prompted Thorne to pen the alert was easily the most severe the lab had ever experienced. The test failure happened on a Saturday afternoon, as three engineers, John Holman, John Grobler, and Robert Trischel, subjected one of the 250-pound batteries to strong vibration. They had just walked out of the room where the tests were conducted when there was a tremendous explosion, strong enough to rattle the 2-inch solid wooden door. Holman threw the door open and ran in. The mechanism meant to shake and vibrate the battery was all but obscured by blue-green flames shooting 10 feet to the ceiling. Fire! He yelled as he grabbed an extinguisher. The room began to fill with black smoke and flames. Two technicians were missing. Holman got on his hands and knees and began looking for them as fire trucks screamed up to the laboratory. Chemical extinguishers failed to put the fire out. The men slipped rags over their faces and began unbolting the still-burning battery from the shaker. The battery exploded a second time, drenching them in the potassium hydroxide solution that served as the battery's electrolyte. Shrapnel was embedded in the ceiling and walls. The engineers took the burning battery out of the building. Its 16-gauge steel case was peeled open like foil, and the silver plating on the battery was partially melted. As soon as they could, they raced back inside to drench themselves in the laboratory's emergency showers. Then the three lab employees and three firemen were rushed to the hospital to be treated for smoke inhalation and chemical burns. The lab called for the recall within 2 or 3 days of the incident. A similar battery failure on Scorpion could have been enough to cause a warhead to explode, but the alert was sent too late to save the sub and crew. The phrase, withdrawn from service at the earliest opportunity, was usually construed to mean that a recall should be conducted as each boat reached port. When the recommendation reached the Ordnance Command, Scorpion was either already lost or still en route to Norfolk, where the recall would have been implemented. Had the alert been made available to Craven right after the accident, months might have been shaved off the search for Scorpion. But instead of sharing the information, the Ordnance Command continued to insist that such an explosion was impossible. Had the Court of Inquiry been given the information, it might have done much more to solve the mystery. But the Court, in its report, clearly relied heavily on Naval Ordnance's statements about the impossibility of an onboard detonation. That the lab's alert made it to the Ordnance Command is certain. It was specifically coded to be routed from the mailroom straight to the commander's desk. In addition, some weeks after Scorpion's wreckage was found, a representative of the Ordnance Command showed up at the Keyport lab, called Thorne into a private office in another building, and castigated him for including warnings of warhead cook-off and loss of a submarine in the alert. The command had good reason to be deeply concerned by what Thorne wrote. Naval Ordnance had created the potential for catastrophe by bypassing its own safety procedures. In its effort to keep up with the sub-fleet's demands for the torpedoes, it had rushed the weapons into production. The fleet desperately needed torpedoes that could go fast enough to catch the new classes of Soviet nuclear subs. But manufacturers were having a terrible time building components that could pass safety tests. There was such a backlog caused by repeated battery failures that the Keyport lab was at least 2 months behind in its quality assurance tests. Rather than slow down production, the Ordnance Command had been issuing torpedoes with components from lots that had never been safely tested at all. That was a clear violation of regulations that required that 3 samples from every lot of 100 batteries be tested before any battery from the lot was issued to the fleet. The samples were supposed to be subjected to 2 or 3 weeks of tests, measuring their resilience to shock, heat, vibration, and any other condition that could be expected to occur on a submarine. Only after the samples passed muster was the Ordnance Command supposed to allow any of the components on board any submarine. 2 companies had originally contracted to manufacture the batteries and suffered so many failures that the Navy brought in a 3rd company to try to make up for the production problems. That company never managed to produce any batteries that passed quality assurance tests. But because of the shortages, the contractor was allowed to ship as many as 250 of its batteries to the fleets. It was one of the 3rd company's batteries that exploded in the lab. All 3 companies were having problems because the basic design of the batteries was dangerously flawed. Engineers had warned of this from the first failures back in 1966, well over a year before the catastrophic explosion that resulted in that last and strongest alert. Throughout that time, they had said the batteries had no margin of safety and recommended a redesign. The Ordnance Command was unwilling to do that. The problem existed in how the batteries were activated. A sliver of foil that governed the flow of electrolyte into the power cells was etched to be only 1/7,000th of an inch thick. That was because it was supposed to break with pressure, allowing the battery to power the torpedo's propulsion motor when the weapon was activated. In a typical hot run, the kind Craven imagined had occurred, a torpedo receives an inadvertent startup charge, fully activating the battery and also turning on the motor. That condition is easily detected as a spinning propeller on the torpedo alerts crews to the need for an immediate 180-degree turn. The kind of failure experienced in the lab was far more insidious because there never would have been enough power in the battery to turn on a motor or cause the torpedo propeller to spin. Instead, what happened to the batteries in the testing lab and what caused the explosion of the test sample was more difficult to detect. The lab discovered that when the batteries were subjected to vibrations, the electrolyte was pushed against that thin diaphragm with enough force to only partially rupture the foil. This allowed just enough electrolyte to slowly leak into the battery's power cells to cause them to begin to spark and overheat. It was precisely because the diaphragms broke so easily and the overheating condition could remain hidden until a fire or explosion, that the lab determined that the design had almost no margin of safety. During the vibration test that Thorne described in his letter, there was no hint of a problem until the battery exploded into flames. If the same thing had happened on a submarine, it was entirely possible that no one would have noticed anything was wrong unless they smelled insulation burning or touched the torpedo and felt heat. By then, the battery could have been only minutes away from exploding. If the hot torpedo shell is not discovered until the paint begins to blister or burn, Thorne wrote to Craven, there may not be time to move the torpedo from a stowage rack and load it into a tube for jettison before warhead cook-off. Such a torpedo accident could have occurred in any of the 14 Mark 37 torpedoes on Scorpion, or for that matter, on any of the submarines equipped with those torpedoes. Carrying a battery from a defective lot would have heightened the risk, but the risk existed in the design, nonetheless. The diaphragm on one or several of the batteries could have ruptured as the weapons lay in torpedo tubes or in their racks. Men didn't have to be testing them or handling them in any way. Shipboard vibration could have been enough. Scorpion may have been more at risk than any other boat. The vibration tests in the lab that led to the explosion were supposed to emulate the usual vibrations that could be expected on board a sub and when transporting torpedoes to a submarine, vibrations that were far less severe than the shaking Scorpion had suffered in the 1967 incident when she was sent corkscrewing through the water. Naval Ordnance has never acknowledged that Scorpion could have been at risk for torpedo detonation, or even that Scorpion's torpedoes were powered by batteries with a defective design. In fact, after the sub was lost, the Naval Underwater Systems Center in Newport, Rhode Island, vigorously argued against the test lab's conclusions. Naval Ordnance also withheld the information about the flawed battery design even after another torpedo battery began to heat up on board a submarine in the Western Pacific, months after Scorpion was lost. The crew of the second boat reported that their torpedo battery reached temperatures so high they had to spray the torpedo constantly with water to cool it. The water turned to steam. They had no choice but to continue spraying until the torpedo could be loaded into a tube and jettisoned. Finally, about a year after Scorpion went down, Naval Ordnance did order a new battery design. The new system replaced the thin foil diaphragm with two stronger ones. In this new design, both diaphragms could be broken only when they were mechanically punctured with a cookie-cutter device, eliminating the danger that shipboard vibration could lead to a battery fire and set off an explosion. Any written record of the Keyport Lab's alert and the alert itself appear to be missing. There should be copies of the engineer's alert at the main administrative offices of the Naval Undersea Warfare Engineering Center, formerly the Naval Torpedo Station, at Keyport, and at the Ordnance Command. But another recent request made under the Freedom of Information Act for a copy of the alert at both sites came back with the answer that there was no record of it, or even of its destruction, something that also should have been logged if the alert was removed from the files. Still, after hearing Thorne's story, Craven and some sub-commanders and weapons experts are looking back at the Scorpion disaster. Craven is angry that the Ordnance Command failed to disclose the fires itself. The public and the press and a lot of other people feel an organization is engaged in a cover-up when they so stoutly deny this kind of thing, he says. Taking the new evidence into account, Craven theorizes that the cry that led Scorpion's skipper to make that final turn could have been "hot torpedo" instead of "hot running torpedo." Chester M. Mack, who skippered Lapun when she searched for the downed Scorpion, insists that no captain would ever take the time to ask for more information before executing an immediate 180-degree turn. Hot torpedo. There's only one thing it could mean. The damn thing is running in the torpedo room, Mack says. After years of being told over and over again that he was wrong, that it was impossible for a torpedo to detonate on board Scorpion, Craven is now convinced that he has what is very possibly the final piece to the mystery he set out to solve more than a quarter of a century ago. It is a mystery that continues to unfold. In 1998, almost 5 years after the Navy released the Court of Inquiry report, almost 5 years after Craven first spoke to Thorne, the Navy released a 1970 report by another technical advisory group. This one convened shortly after Craven retired from the Navy. It was set up to review pictures and data collected by Trieste during her 9 dives down to Scorpion. The report had been completed only a year after the Court of Inquiry had finished its work, but the document had been held back from the public, from the Scorpion families, even after the Court of Inquiry report was released, and even though it specifically discounts many of the conclusions reached by the Court of Inquiry. The TAG report does agree with the Court of Inquiry findings in one profound way. Both say there is no evidence that Scorpion was attacked. Still, lingering rumors and periodic news articles continue to place blame for Scorpion's loss on an attack by the Soviets. This advisory group throws out the Court of Inquiry's conclusion that Scorpion was likely felled by the external explosion of an ejected torpedo that turned back on her. It also tosses out the possibility that Scorpion was destroyed by an internal torpedo explosion. Still, the authors of the report clearly did not have the information about the torpedo battery failures in the Keyport lab. Indeed, Craven, Thorne, and some submarine captains believe that much of the evidence used to refute the torpedo theory actually supports it. The group's report also makes no attempt at all to explain why Scorpion was found just where Craven said she would be if her captain had turned to battle what he believed was a hot-running torpedo. Instead, the Navy had gone back to debating the meaning of the acoustic trail Craven and his team followed to Scorpion's grave. Although the details of the Scorpion search and the crucial role Craven played were retold in a second report the Navy declassified at the same time, the 1970 analysis instead relies heavily on naval ordnance assurances that Scorpion could not have suffered a torpedo accident. The group, in short, based its conclusions on statements made by the same Navy Department that was withholding critical information that had been kept from the Court of Inquiry and the search teams. By the time the second report was written, Naval Ordnance's argument had changed. Instead of insisting that a torpedo could never explode on board a sub, Naval Ordnance had focused on the visual evidence collected by Trieste. From the outside, the hull of the torpedo room looked basically intact, while the ship's battery well was largely destroyed. The Trieste pictures did show that all three hatches leading from the torpedo room through the pressure hull, the forward escape trunk access, the escape trunk hatch, and torpedo loading hatch, were all dislodged. Trieste could not get cameras inside the torpedo room to check for internal damage. In 1986, another attempt was made to examine the wreckage. This time, Woods Hole's Alvin submersible was sent down, toting the Jason Jr., a remote-controlled swimmer camera. The report from that expedition is still classified, but people with access to the findings say that the Jason could not enter the torpedo room. A team analyzing that expedition said as much in a letter dated January 14, 1987, that was declassified in 1998, along with the TAG report. As the report states, "The most logical location for an internal explosion that would cause the loss of the submarine would be the torpedo room. However, the evidence indicates that the torpedo room is essentially intact. It is possible that the explosion of a single weapon could rupture the pressure hull in the keel area and cause the loss of the submarine. Thus, this possibility must be considered. However, experts from NAVORD have stated that the explosion of one weapon would cause sympathetic explosions of others. If more than one weapon exploded, there would be extensive damage to the bow section, which would have the appearance of outward deformation. There is no deformation of the nature in any of the visible structure, nor is there deformation to indicate an explosion in a torpedo tube. Internal explosion in the forward room is considered unlikely." Because of that argument, the technical advisory group also discounted the simulated reenactment of Scorpion's loss staged by Craven and Fountain. Still, Craven and several munitions experts say that the Ordnance Command's argument is deeply flawed, and that if the command had told investigators about the failures of the batteries on the Mark 37 torpedoes, the analysis would have been changed considerably. The kind of external hull damage the Ordnance Command insisted would have followed a torpedo explosion, weapons experts say, may not have followed a torpedo explosion caused by a fire. Rather, the damage the command was describing would likely occur during a full-triggered explosion, an explosion in which a torpedo is set off just the way it is designed to be set off, with the power of 330 pounds of HBX explosives unleashed all at once in a massive and directed forward thrust. That kind of detonation would, the experts agree, likely detonate other torpedoes. And a multiple detonation would, as Naval Ordnance said, probably crack or at least buckle the submarine's hull in a way that would be visible from the outside. But the fact that there was a possibility of a torpedo detonation caused by fire in the torpedo battery profoundly changes the equation. A weapons explosion caused by fire will almost certainly not be the same power or predictable shape of a neatly triggered explosion. In fact, there is no way to predict the size, the shape, the properties of a blast caused by fire. Such blasts just don't follow the usual rules. It is, weapons experts say, entirely possible, even probable, that a torpedo warhead set off by a fire could go up in what is known as a low-order detonation. A low-order detonation could be strong enough to kill anyone nearby, and could be strong enough to blow the hatches in a torpedo room without setting off other torpedoes, especially if those other torpedoes were not laying directly against the torpedo that exploded. Submarines often went out without their torpedo racks full. That's why men often bunked in the torpedo rooms. Any torpedo rack without a torpedo laying on top of it made a reasonable place for a mattress. One low-order detonation, without subsequent detonations of other torpedoes nearby, could easily occur without the kind of external hull damage the men diving on Trieste had been told to look for. The Navy itself acknowledged that to be entirely possible in the 1969 Court of Inquiry report into Scorpion's loss. The report cites a 1960 incident on the USS Sargo, SSN 583, in which an oxygen fire in the after torpedo room spread and caused two Mark 37 torpedo warheads to detonate low order. The report states, "The pressure hull of the Sargo was not ruptured. Sargo was pier side and on the surface at Pearl Harbor at the time." Indeed, the fact that Scorpion's torpedo room is intact raises the probability that she was lost to a torpedo casualty, say subcommanders and Craven. Scorpion's torpedo room did not implode, which makes it very likely that it was flooded before she fell to crush depth. Since a flooded room is exposed to equal ocean pressures both inside and out, it does not collapse at crush depth, and it does not implode. It is left intact. The technical advisory group does say that the torpedo room hatches probably failed when pressure inside the torpedo room increased, or when the bulkhead leading to the operations compartment gave way. The idea seems to be that the hatches were forced open by the violent implosions going on right outside the torpedo room. The advisory group offers no theory about why the torpedo room would have lost only its hatches when the group's own experts say compartments just outside were completely destroyed in the same violent instant. Trieste's pictures show that Scorpion's operations compartment, which is right next to the torpedo room, is squashed flat, and that just beyond operations, Scorpion's tail has telescoped completely into her auxiliary machine space. The Trieste photos also show that the massive battery that powered Scorpion was torn apart. The advisory group theorizes that this is what destroyed Scorpion, echoing the theory about what destroyed the Soviet Gulf. The sub's battery could have exploded as it was being charged if ventilators failed and the concentration of highly combustible hydrogen gas was allowed to build up. The battery, however, could also have been torn apart by the same forces that destroyed the rest of the submarine. Admiral Shade, Fountain, and others have guessed that perhaps Scorpion's trash disposal unit failed, allowing tons of seawater to pour into the sub and into the battery well. Seawater can cause a battery to emit a number of gases, including hydrogen gas. The trash disposal theory is based on the fact that a trash disposal unit failed on the USS Shark, SSN-591, Scorpion's sister ship. Shark survived. Again, many of these observers had discounted that the first flooding could have been caused by a torpedo, because they were told that there was no way for a torpedo to explode on board Scorpion, certainly not without blowing up the rest of the weapons as well. "I think we are all guessing," says Ross E. Saxon, who went down on Trieste and took some of the photographs studied by the technical advisory group. "We who were out there, who dove down on the thing, are guessing." Saxon and two others aboard Trieste also believe that they saw an object that looked like a body wearing an orange life jacket near Scorpion's wreckage. They saw it in passing and could not go back immediately because the Trieste is not very maneuverable. Later, nobody could find the object. Craven says it's entirely possible that someone could have attempted to get out at the last minute through an escape hatch. If there was a torpedo explosion, it would have had to have occurred reasonably close to the surface, or the acoustic sounds would have been lost. However, he also says that objects are sighted on the ocean floor all the time, and often don't turn out to be what they appear. Saxon says he can't be certain one way or the other, but he agrees that there is reason to believe Scorpion was close to the surface when she suffered her fatal mishap. Her masts appear to be in the upright position, as if her commander tried to send out a last-minute message. It is also possible, however, that the masts were thrown up by mechanical shock or the explosive forces tearing apart the submarine. Offered the new information about the flawed torpedo batteries, some people close to the investigation who had discounted a torpedo explosion after the 1970 report now say that a torpedo explosion has to be put back on the list of possible causes of Scorpion's loss. "If a room blows up and there was a hand grenade there, but then I call up and say I took the hand grenade out of the room, you would discount the hand grenade," says an active-duty Navy official familiar with the case through its latest developments. "If I didn't tell you there were two hand grenades, though, if someone was being less than fully truthful, providing less than all of the information, maybe there would be cause to go back and look at it again. Based on the information on file now, the two most likely causes are a ship's battery explosion and a weapons cook-off. Based on the information we had, I'd say battery explosion. Now there is a good way for a weapon to cook off. Any information about specific engineering problems in a weapon ought to be tossed into the fore, ought to be discussed." The officer, as well as Craven and many others, agree that there needs to be more investigation, perhaps another effort to take a look inside Scorpion's torpedo room. For now, Craven remains convinced that a torpedo was the most likely cause of the sub's loss. He is not alone. In June 1998, Craven stood before a throng of Navy officers when he became the first man to be given the Distinguished Civilian Service Award by the Naval Submarine League for his work on Scorpion, Polaris, and other projects. When the ceremony was over, an officer approached him. his voice lowered so that it wouldn't carry through the crowded room, the officer began talking about Scorpion and told Craven that he had been convinced for years that she was lost after a torpedo accident. Without knowing about the alert sent from Keyport, without knowing that there were known problems with the batteries powering the Mark 37 torpedoes, the officer told Craven, "I know it was a torpedo, because I had a torpedo battery cook off on me." Chapter 6. The Ballad of Whitey Mack. Commander Chester M. Mack, a 6-foot-6-inch maverick known as Whitey, after his pure blonde pate, looked through his periscope out onto the Barents Sea. He was here in search of a new and lethal Soviet ballistic missile submarine that NATO had dubbed, without mirth, the Yankee. It was March 1969, and in one terrifying technological leap, the Soviets had finally come out with a nuclear-powered missile sub with a design that seemed borrowed from Polaris and that might be capable of striking the White House or the Pentagon from more than 1,000 miles offshore. It was Mack's job to learn more about it. Mack had driven his sub straight through the Barents, the zealously guarded training area for the Northern Fleet, the Soviet Navy's most advanced and powerful. He was traveling with the arrogance of somebody who knew he was at the helm of one of the Navy's newest subs, a Sturgeon-class attack boat armed with the latest sonar and eavesdropping equipment. He was also traveling with a lot more luck than most, because in this game of hit and miss, he had just found what he was looking for. There, in front of his scope, was a Yankee, 429 feet long, 39 feet across, weighing in at 9,600 tons. Mack sidled Lapon up to within 300 yards and stared. "Holy Christ, that son of a bitch looks like a Mattel model," he blurted out. The submarine was indeed a Polaris look-alike, from the shape of its hull down to its sail-mounted diving planes. The image might have been broadcast down in the crew's mess on a television wired to the periscope, what submariners called periviz. But on this early run, nobody could get the periviz to work properly. So only Mack could see the amazing feat his men and his sub were pulling off. A Hasselblad single-lens reflex camera was hooked onto the periscope, and Mack pulled the trigger on the pistol grip device. Film advanced on a motorized drive, several shots for each pull on the trigger. As Lapon moved slowly forward, Mack lifting her scope out of the water for only 7 seconds at a time in an effort to avoid detection. With each peek of the periscope, he grabbed a few photos, each time capturing another small portion of the massive boat. It would take 7 of the photos pasted together to show the entire Yankee. During the years the first Yankees were under construction, U.S. intelligence had collected little more than fuzzy images captured by spy satellites, showing the Soviets were preparing to mass-produce the new weapon. But over the last year, as the Yankees ventured out on sea trials, U.S. surveillance subs had been moving in for a closer look at this nuclear monster, decorated with 16 doors, hiding 16 portable missile silos. The Yankee seemed a huge advance over the other ballistic missile subs the Soviets had put to sea, the diesel-powered Zulus and Gulfs, and the first nuclear-powered missile boats, the Hotels. None of those boats had inspired the same fear the Yankee inspired now. The earlier subs were loud and easy for SOSUS and sonar to spot. Now the U.S. sub-force was faced with a crucial question. Did the Yankee mimic more than Polaris's shape? Was it possible that just 6 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviets were positioned to launch a first strike with little or no warning? If the subs were as silent and deadly as they seemed, then at the very least, the Soviets would have matched the United States in creating a second strike capability, a way to punch back if all their land missiles and bombers were destroyed. Captain James Bradley knew his spy program had already produced a lot of critical information about the development of Soviet subs and missiles. Photographing the sunken Gulf had been a technological coup, but the Gulfs posed little threat compared to the Yankees, and nothing was more important now than learning how to find these new subs, how to destroy them. Photos of a Yankee did only so much good. The U.S. Navy and its NATO allies needed to see these boats in action, see just where they carried their missiles, needed to collect sound signatures to ensure that the subs could never pass SOSUS listening nets unheard, and so that surveillance subs and sonar buoys dropped by P-3 Orion subhunter planes could recognize the threat as it passed. Someone had to get close to a Yankee in action, and he would have to stay close enough for long enough to give the United States ammunition to counter the new threat. For this, almost any risks were warranted. As pumped up as Mac was from his photographic feat, he knew that the real star of the subforce would be the man who accomplished a long trail. Other commanders knew it too, and even the loss of Scorpion was not enough to kill the fighter jock bravado that the new mission was sparking within the ranks. But Mac was feeling quite proprietary about the Yankees now, and he was certain he could be the guy to get in close and stay there. He was sure of that, even though nobody else had been able to. Mac had that kind of an ego. In fact, everything about this 37-year-old commander was big. His towering 240-pound frame didn't quite fit through Lapon's low hatches and narrow passageways, and he was almost always bent over in the control room, littered overhead with a maze of piping and wire. Submarines were just too small to contain Whitey Mac. He was a larger-than-life renegade, much like the heroes in the novels he devoured by the basketful. He saw himself as the hero in a story he was writing as he went along, a story ruled by his own tactics and sometimes by his own rules. He had never attended the Naval Academy. Instead, he was recruited into Officer's Candidate School by a brash ROTC XO at Pennsylvania State University, who bragged that he won his wife in a poker game. Mac himself was the son of a Pennsylvania coal miner, and he held up this lack of official polish as a badge of honor. Mac labeled himself a smart-ass kind of guy, and he faced down his superiors with piercing blue eyes and a brand of brass that had nothing to do with epaulette stars. With wry irony, he sported a homemade pair of Russian dolphins alongside his standard American dolphins, the emblem of the U.S. submarine fleet, and he liked nothing better than to rush about his submarine, shouting obscenities in Russian. A faint heart never fucked a pig. That was Lapon's motto, and it had been ever since Mac's first voyage on the sub, when he used the phrase to announce his decision to follow a new Soviet sub close to her territorial waters. The line was recorded on a continuous tape running in Lapon's control room. Although when the subject came up once in front of an admiral, Mac delicately altered the phrase to, "A faint heart never won a fair maiden." Mac had plunged into command of Lapon in late 1967, first by horse trading with other commanders for the men he believed would create an all-star crew, then by installing all manner of experimental and often unauthorized equipment on his submarine. He alternately inspired and mercilessly drove his men. He alternately impressed and badgered senior admirals until he was allowed to skip the usual months of U.S.-based shakedown training and head straight into the action. To a large degree, Mac was emblematic of his era. Throughout the subforce, Captains who avoided risks were branded with nicknames such as Charlie Tuna or Chicken of the Sea. Still, Mac left his superiors, not to mention other commanders who prided themselves on their own daring, debating whether he was dangerously blurring the line between valor and recklessness. To be sure, those close-up photos of the Yankee were as valuable as any intelligence anyone had gotten lately. But Mac had also taken other immense risks for limited intelligence return. Lapon had already been detected in the Barents once under Mac's watch. It may have been a glint of sunlight off her periscope, no one was sure, but suddenly the men in Lapon's radio shack heard a Soviet pilot sending out an alert in Russian. "I see a submarine." When Lapon's officer of the deck pointed his periscope toward the sky, he saw a helicopter pilot who seemed to be looking right at him. "He's got the biggest fucking red mustache I ever saw," the officer exclaimed. "That's close enough," Max said, breathless, as he raced from his personal quarters into the control room, still in his skivvies. "We better get the hell out of here." With that, he got his boat out of Dodge before the Soviets had a chance to mount a full search. Mac had also driven so close to two Soviet subs conducting approach and attack runs that Lapon ended up in the path of one of their torpedoes. Mac knew that for an exercise like this, the Soviets were shooting duds, but he had no intention of proving his point by letting the torpedo hit. Instead, he sent the order to the engine room that kicked Lapon into high speed. Flying balls to the wall, as submariners say, Mac outraced the weapon. The incident occurred just after he had taken Lapon out searching for Scorpion, though well before anyone realized that a torpedo might have killed that boat. Two spooks on board, George T. Tommy Cox and Joseph Jesse James, were so shaken by the incident that when they later tried to grab a smoke in the radio room, neither man could steady himself long enough to light up. Cox wanted to be a country western singer, had once taken first place at the Gene Hooper Country Western Show Talent Contest in Caribou, Maine, and had worked his way through high school, playing backup at a place called Cindy's Bar. After this trip on Lapon, he recorded a ballad called Torpedo in the Water on his first and only collection of submarine greatest hits, Take Her Deep. The song was an ode to a close call. "There's a 400-pounder of TNT about to blow us to eternity. Gee, I hate to see a grown man cry, but goodness knows that I'm too young to die. Torpedo in the water, and it's closing fast." From her encounter with the torpedo, Lapon carried back transcripts and photographs of the initial part of the test, as well as rolls of film filled with other Soviet activities. All of it interesting, none of it crucial, none of it enough to make Whitey a star, the star of the Atlantic Fleet. Instead, it was another man who was so heralded, Kennard R. McKee, a lithe southern gentleman with bushy eyebrows and a showman's flair. He had set the standard for surveillance operations when he was on the USS Dace, SSN 607. And even though McKee's stellar command was nearly over by the time Mac photographed the Yankee in March 1969, he stood as an icon in the subforce. In 1967, McKee had not only photographed a Soviet nuclear-powered icebreaker as it was being towed, but he grabbed radioactive air samples that proved the ship had suffered a reactor accident. The next year, in one breathtaking mission, McKee collected the first close-up photographs and sound signatures of not one, but two of the second generation of Soviet nuclear-powered subs, an attack sub and a cruise missile sub that NATO had named the Victor and the Charlie. He had found one of the new subs in the waters off Novaya Zemlya, a large island between the Barents and the Kara Seas that was one of the Soviets' main nuclear test areas. Like Mac, McKee had been detected. Indeed, he had snapped a photograph of a Soviet crew member standing on the deck of one of the subs and pointing right at the Dace's periscope just before the Soviets began to chase. McKee had to outrace a group of Soviet surface patrols, pinging wildly with active sonar. He finally managed his escape by driving Dace straight under the hazardous reaches of the Arctic ice. When it was safe to emerge, he continued his mission, locating the second new Soviet sub within a week. "Gentlemen, the price of poker has just gone up in the Barents Sea," McKee announced on his return at a session with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and members of the Defense Department. With typical flair, he captured his audience with a briefing no less dramatic for his exclusion of the detection and his omission of the shot of the Soviet crewman pointing at Dace. McKee's presentation, and his slideshow of other photographs shot through his scope, went over so well that his immediate superiors never thought to criticize him for allowing his sub to be detected. Instead, for McKee, the mission was marred only by the fact that the Navy had refused to let him name the Soviet submarines he had found. His manner, as much as anything, was what separated McKee from the likes of Whitey Mack. McKee was everybody's idea of a hero. While Mack bullied his way through the system, McKee was one of those officers pegged early on for the fast track to the top. This was a man who courted his sweetheart, Betty Ann, by spinning her through a winter's night in a Jaguar convertible with the top down, and then spun her about with a marriage proposal 13 days later. On Dace, he courted the vigilance of his junior officers by promising cases of Dewar's Scotch and Jack Daniels to any who helped him spot the new Soviet subs. He won over admirals with the same flair, conjuring up such amazing tales of his exploits that the men who reigned over the U.S. submarine force never thought to question the risks he took. Mack also had other competition in the Atlantic Fleet. There was Alfred L. Kellen, the commanding officer of the USS Ray, SSN 653, who had shot the very first pictures of a Yankee. Then there was Commander Guy H.B. Schaefer of the USS Greenling, SSN 614, who had slipped his sub directly beneath both a Charlie and a Yankee a few months before Mack spotted one. That gave Greenling's crew a chance to record the noise levels and the harmonics that the Soviet boats created in the water, and the chance to film the hull and propeller underwater through the periscope with a new low-light television camera. Indeed, Greenling got so close to the underside of the Yankee that had the Soviets checked their fathometer, the ocean would have seemed very shallow, perhaps not more than 12 feet deep. The job, known as underhulling, was enormously dangerous. At any time, one of the Soviet submarines could have moved to submerge right on top of Greenling. But the payoff was enormous as well. The United States had the first acoustic fingerprint of a Yankee submarine, and the sounds from Greenling's tapes were quickly plugged into the SOSUS computers. Now, one question remained. Would the data collected by Greenling be enough to make the Yankees stand out as they moved into the open ocean din of fishing boats, marine life, and currents? Nobody would know that until somebody accomplished the longer trail through an actual deployment. The race was on. Mack and the other commanders took their turns, steaming again out past 50 degrees north latitude, out of U.S. waters, and out of touch with fleet leaders back home, toward the Barents Sea and the Yankees' home ports. Tightly coordinating their efforts with U.S. submariners, British subs sometimes helped fill in what had become a nearly seamless round-robin surveillance of the Soviet ports in the Barents. There were only a couple of British subs trained for the task, and they went near Soviet shores only during spring and fall. But those subs were dedicated to the spy mission, and that's what their commanders and crews specialized in. They were good at it, and they were aggressive. The British Royal Navy just didn't mind confronting the Soviets. Once a Soviet surface ship tried lining the Strait of Sicily near Italy with twin-cylinder buoys, and it seemed to U.S. intelligence that it was an effort to create an acoustic barrier, a sort of floating SOSUS net. There was great hand-wringing from the U.S. State Department to the Navy, debates about whether the United States should just go in and grab the buoys, when suddenly somebody noticed they had vanished. It turns out the British had a squadron of destroyers in Malta that went in and sank each and every one of the devices with naval gunfire. Mack's chance came in September 1969. As Lapon pulled out of Norfolk, she was stocked with a mountain of eggs, meat, and syrupy drink mixes known as bug juice, typical fare for a long mission. There was, however, one major exception. Her mess held 3 months' worth of frozen blueberries. Mack had a voracious appetite for blueberries and blueberry muffins, and he shared his passion with his crew. On board were also ingredients enough to fuel weekly pizza nights and a one-armed bandit to stave off boredom. There never would have been room for a slot machine on Gudgeon or any of the other diesel boats that went out on the first spec ops. That's not to say Lapon wasn't cramped, but at least each man had his own rack. No hot bunking, no sharing. The racks were still stacked one atop another, shelves with mattresses on them, and some mattresses were still crammed in among the torpedoes, but there was some relief in having 15 square feet or so of private space that could be curtained off from the rest of the crew. And just about everyone had a single drawer, although that was all the space they had to store 3 months' worth of skivvies, uniforms, and anything else they believed they couldn't live without. The diesel stench was gone with these nukes, as was the condensation that had plagued the diesel submarines. Lapon was downright comfortable, practically climate-controlled for anyone who didn't mind the constant clouds of cigarette smoke that masked despite the advanced air-filtering system. Nobody expected much more from life in their closed sewer pipe. For most of the guys, contact with the outside would be pretty much limited to Paraviz and Family Grams, the 3 or 4 line messages that wives